Mark's already alluded to the topic of the message today. We're carrying on with our work through John. We're coming up to the crucifixion narrative in John's Gospel. And so Mark wanted to line it up with Easter because it would make perfect sense to do that. So we're going to be in John 18 this morning. For those of you that haven't read John 18 before, it is a collection of timeline story that John is writing, of the narrative of when Jesus goes to Gethsemane, then is arrested, the betrayal takes place, and then you have the denial of Jesus by Peter, and then it goes through to the trial of Jesus, and then he stands before Pilate. And it's got that classic line in there, "What is truth?" that comes from Pilate. So that's John 18, and I'm going to work a little bit through the book as I go, through the chapter as I go this morning. But before I dig into the message, Mark, I spoke to Mark a few weeks ago, and he asked me to share a couple of stories, one story that I'd heard about a couple of people that had come to faith recently in the area. I'm just going to leave that there. There's a friend of mine, she's running a church in Corfmullen, and I won't say which one, but she's Anglican, and she's running a church in Corfmullen, and they're running an Alpha course, and she's got a few people on the Alpha course, and she's got a group of men on the Alpha course, five men all together. Two of these men recently became Christians, and one's a plumber, and I don't know what the other one does. And the stories of them are actually quite remarkable. So the plumber was going about his daily business one day, and God spoke to him. No, nothing about church, no church background, no Christian background, never read the Bible before. God spoke to him and told him that he needed to become a Christian, follow Jesus, and go to church. So he rang the local church that he knew was down the road and said, "What do I do? Do I have to book an appointment? Like, how do I join the membership so that I can come along to the services?" He had no framework for knowing how you actually go to church. That's how distant he was from the whole thing. And of course, we've got a system in place that we have to follow through. They thought it was a joke. The people on the end of the phone that we had getting this phone call midweek thought it was a joke. They thought he was having a laugh until he turned up on Sunday and said, "Oh, you know, I've come along. I've been told, you know, to sign up or sign in or something," and he did not know what to do. So anyway, they basically led this guy through some knowledge about Jesus, came along to the church, began to integrate, and he's like, "There he is in an Alpha course." There's another chap on the Alpha course, and his one is equally bizarre. He, during COVID-19, decided he was going to check out all the religions in the world to see if there's anything in any of these things. And as he's reading the Bible, he comes to a sudden revelation of this is true. This is God. And God speaks to him. And so he goes along to the local church down the road, which happens to be the same church, and roughly a similar time to this chap. And so he starts studying and learning more. And now he's on the Alpha course. Two guys. Completely unevangelized, completely unconnected with traditional church, who have both come to Christ separately and are now sitting on an Alpha course. And I won't tell you who's on the Alpha course, but there's other people on the Alpha course and they're quite influential. So what's remarkable about this story for me is this is the stuff you read about. And yet it's just happening down the road. What else don't we know about that the Lord is doing? What else is he at work? Speaking to a friend of mine, and he was talking to me about how when he goes to various places as a businessman, when he goes to various places, he's always, "What is the Lord saying to me in this circumstance? What is he telling me to do in this circumstance?" And I was sitting with him on Friday, and I said, "Yeah." I said, "The other question is, what has he already done that you weren't a part of?" Like, we all talk about how he goes before us. We all talk about how he's prepared and made a way. We don't practice it. So we don't live as if it's true. So therefore, do we really believe it? I mean, if you really believed your house was on fire, you would live as if it was true. You'd be out the door. Or you'd be running the water and trying to chuck it on the fire, right? You wouldn't just sit there going, "Yes, I believe that." What do we actually live by when the rubber hits the road? And this is part of my leading into this chapter 18. Because following Jesus up until this point has been all about the power of God at work. The healings, the miracles, the demons that are cast out, the walking on water, the calming the storms, the power of God manifest through Jesus Christ and through the disciples, the working of the Holy Spirit in the environment where they were. Wherever Jesus went, the kingdom showed up. People even just had to touch the hem of his garment and they were instantly healed. And this narrative around the Messiah who is coming, the king who's going to take his throne, the establishment of the way of God that's going to take place. And all of the disciples, without exception, were believing in that framework that God is going to conquer all. The mountains shake before him, the demons run and flee at the mention of the King of Majesty. Right? So the power of God was all about ruling, conquering, being proved to be right. But we don't believe in that anymore as Christians, do we? We're not obsessed with being right. We're not obsessed with, if only God's ways were in power, everything would be great. And so we come to chapter 18 in John's Gospel. And I've got 20 minutes, if that. I've got 25 minutes. Oh, gosh. Hurry up, Gareth. Stop pausing. When Jesus had spoken these words, he's just done the high priestly prayer. For those of you that would be desperate, just feel free to read chapter 17 while I waffle on and you can catch up. Jesus has spoken these words. Effectively, Jesus has just talked about how they would be known for their love. He wanted them to be united in love, that the power of God is manifest in love, not in victory over powers and authorities on earth. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forward with his disciples over to the ravine of Kidron. It was a winter ravine. It used to run with streams in the winter. It would have quite a flood, sometimes with deluge of rain. But in it was a garden of Gethsemane. John skips over so much, and I'm going to try and stay in John today and honor John through that. In Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered with his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So Jesus, knowing all these things that were coming upon him, went forward and said to them, "Who do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. So when he said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore he again asked, "Who do you seek?" And he said to them, they said to them, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If you seek me, let these others go their way, to fulfill the word which he spoke," which is from the previous chapter, "of those whom you have given me, I have lost not one." What a statement over our families that would be. Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear, and the slave's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put the sword into your sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" So the Roman cohort and the commanders and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest, but Peter was standing at the outside door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Then the slave girl, who was at the door, said to Peter, "You are not one of the man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I'm not." Now the slaves and the officers were standing there, and having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and they were warming themselves, and Peter also with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus, his disciples, about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus asked him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews came together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I have said. When he had said this, one of the officers standing next to Jesus said, is this the way you answer the high priest? Jesus answered him and said, if I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me? So Annas sent him to Caiaphas, bound to the high priest. Now Simon Peter, who was standing warming himself, so they said to him, you are not also one of the disciples, are you? And he denied it, said, I'm not. One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear was cut off, said, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter denied it again, and immediately the rooster crowed. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but they might be able to eat the Passover. Therefore Pilate went out to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? They answered and they said to him, if this man was not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. So Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. The Jews said to him, we are not permitted to put anyone to death. They actually meant by crucifixion. To fulfill the word of Jesus, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he would be to die. Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, are you asking this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me? Pilate answered, I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? Jesus answered him, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I will not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this world. Therefore Pilate said to him, so you are a king? Jesus answered and said, you say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him, but you have a custom that I release someone to you at the Passover. Do you wish that I release for you the king of the Jews? So they cried out again, saying, no, not this man. Release Barabbas. Barabbas was a robber. John's the last disciple alive at the time of this writing. More than likely the last disciple at the time of writing. John is certainly the last gospel author that walked with Jesus. And so if you read the four accounts, the four eyewitness testimony accounts of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, whether you're familiar with the Bible or not, I don't know. But if you read them as testimonial stories of people that walked with Jesus, you will notice something interesting about John compared to the other three. Luke, more so than the other two, you will notice, is obsessed with getting accurate facts and places and times and names. And he's also, as a doctor, more interested in the medical experiences that are going through and some of the healings and miracles. So you'll notice that Luke alludes to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane before the betrayal, sweating drops of blood. It's called hematidrosis. We used to see it in World War II in the Blitz in London. They didn't believe it was real until then, interestingly, in the medical text. It's a sign of great stress. John always writes with a deeper meaning. He is intentional with the way he structures text. He has left certain details out that I could fill in from some of the other Gospels. But I don't want to today, because I want to just understand what John is trying to communicate through this text. And so I've spent the week just sitting in John 18, trying to see more. Just show me more. Show me more. So let's break some of this down. John 18 is the story of the transition from the power of Christ manifest in defeating evil in front of you in the moment to the power of Christ defeating evil for all time. It is moving from working a miracle in the moment. Notice John does not record what the other Gospels record about healing the ear of the person, Malchus. But he is saying it's the right ear, which is synonymous with what Luke says, that it's the right ear. So you can see that the testimony is sitting around. But he doesn't talk about the healing and miracle there. He doesn't go into that. He's telling a deeper story. It's a bit like the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with the, you know, this secret that's written deep within the table, right? It's that that's going on here. And so when you read John, and just to encourage you, baptize yourself in his words for a while. The story around this is the story of the disciples that have followed closely to Jesus for 3 years, doing what he did, saying what he said, going where he went, obeying the voice of the master, healing the sick, and working miracles in his name, and doing all of those things, and seeing the great power. And yet we're coming up to this crescendo of human history where the power of Rome is sitting in governance over the people of Israel. You've got the power of the religious authorities that know the text better than anyone else. They are, the Pharisees were the celebrated preachers of the day, right? The Pharisees are the well-known preachers, the Billy Grahams of their time. No disrespect to Billy Graham. Right? That's who they are. So when we read about Pharisees in here, most of us are using that as a slur word these days. You know, don't call someone a Pharisee. It's a real insult, right? Back then it wasn't. So these people are in power and they're popular. And this sect, let me use the word cult of Judaism that's beginning with this person called Jesus and his followers, is threatening the power balance of the time in Jewish religion. It's threatening it. He is a disruptor. He is winning the hearts of people. His interpretation is dangerous because it is undermining the fabric of the religious institution of the time. And so as a consequence, Jesus is not liked by the religious leaders of the day. In fact, if anything, he is so disliked that, as the Bible has told us many times, they were planning to murder him. But they can't commit murder because that's against their law. So they've got to find a way of killing him without it being their fault. So they find one of his disciples who's willing to cash in. Now Judas maybe, and I've mentioned it before, saw the writing on the wall. He saw that this was coming. And so he decided to cash in early and at least make money out of the last 3 years, because he's been pocketing a little bit anyway. But he's like, at least I can cash in, and then I can take my riches from where this is and I can move on to the next place. In other words, he's basically saying, well, you know, I've gotten everything I can out of that, and so I'm going to cash in and move on to the next organization following. Because it's getting hard here, and I can see where this is going. And so Judas has decided to protect himself. I'm going to look after number one, and I'm going to strip out the money. And so he betrays his friend and the one he follows, Jesus. And he gives him up. So Jesus has gone to a garden with his disciples. He knows this is coming. He knows the trauma he is about to go through, which is crucifixion. He knows it so vividly that he sweats drops of blood in a garden. And then gets up from prayer. And this rabble of people with weapons come to him. Peter is by his side with his sword ready, but Jesus stands in front of all of them and he says, "Who do you seek?" As if it's not obvious, Jesus. But he wants them to answer the question. Because whenever God asks a question, it's never for his benefit. So they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." And I love this. In the NASB, it says, I am he. It doesn't have the he in the original Greek. It basically says, I am. I am. The phrase, if you translate it into Hebrew, Yohevahe, is the noise that came from God when he created the universe. Yod-he-o-vah-he-o, which means let there be light and there was light. Let there be and there was. God names himself when he creates the universe, and out of Jesus' lips comes I am. So powerful a phrase that they step back and fall to the ground because Jesus tells them who he really is. But they don't know that because they're not seeking I am. They're seeking who they think he is. And none of us have got a perception of Jesus that's inaccurate in here, of course. And when he violates that, we don't go through personal wrestles, do we? But he is. So John says the ultimate point of all existence comes from God. And he writes that in John 1. And when Jesus is asked who he is at Gethsemane, he names himself, I am. And under the power of God, they fall to the ground back. And they still don't know who he is. At that point, there's a power transfer. Because Jesus asked them again, who are you seeking? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, that's me. Let these other people go. Let's go. And he becomes obedient to another's authority. The authority of those that would kill him, the authority of those that would beat him, the authority of those that betray him. So Jesus, knowing he is going to be crucified, the most painful death in history, which is why the word excruciating comes from it, who knows it's coming, is now betrayed by his best friend. I remember when I was working in hospital once, I really don't know if I'm going to be able to cope with another 10 minutes and do it. I'll do my best. I remember, I'm not skirting so much. Jesus is betrayed by his best friend. I was working in hospital and I was cleaning, I was helping a nurse to clean one of the beds. And we were just prepping a bed, you know, when a patient moves on and you've got to clean the bed through and then you've got to redo the bed. And I was cleaning that because they're always pressured, so I had a bit of time. Anyway, I was cleaning the bed and we pulled the curtains around a lady that was sitting with somebody, a family visiting their relative next to us. And we're cleaning this bed and behind the curtain, we can hear the niece of this lady who is confused getting her to sign blank checks. So that she may go and empty her confused aunt's bank account. Betrayal. Judas sells Jesus out for the price of a slave, 30 pieces of silver. Jesus takes it. And he moves on. So Jesus is then arrested. Peter has tried to slash somebody's ear off, probably missed, probably went for something more important, but only got an ear. Jesus has healed it. And now Peter is following on from a distance, still hopeful that the power is going to come out and sort this situation out. Despite the betrayal, Jesus can conquer all, right? And so he follows at a distance. John manages to get into the high priest's house, but Peter's on the outside, and so John has to convince somebody to let Peter in. Peter gets in, and on his way in, weren't you one of his followers? Bear in mind, they're questioning Jesus about who his followers are, because they're going to hunt them all down. Let's crush this thing once for all. So they're all hiding. They've all fled. All Jesus' friends have abandoned him. No, I don't. I'm not one of the followers. Why? Because Peter's decided he needs to look after himself, because Jesus hasn't stepped in yet. Like Jesus is going to step in at some point, right? He's going to do something in this space. I want to go into the house where Jesus is with the high priest because I can't wait to see what he's going to do next. Why is he following him in there if he thinks it's too dangerous to be there? He's following him in there because he's still got hope that Jesus is going to come through. He's come through every other time accusation has been leveled against him. Somehow the crowd's part and he walks through. I want to see it again. Doesn't happen. Somebody strikes Jesus on the cheek because he's answered the high priest according to the Levitical law and requires the high priest to hold a proper trial against him. And Jesus gets struck for requiring the high priest to obey the law of God. Why? Because the high priest of God is more interested in his agenda and his status and position than he is with truth. What is real? And so out comes this slap across the face of Jesus and this rebuke. And so Jesus is, but if I've done any wrong, tell me, testify. But if I haven't, he goes back to, let's make sure there's justice. And yet there is not going to be any justice tonight. This is a power play between people. This is people's agendas of how we can twist the truth to get what we know is the right outcome, how we are going to manipulate this situation to get what we believe God wants out of this. That's what the high priest is trying to do. He's trying to get God's will done. And he believes that this man is a usurper, who is a blasphemous man, who is manipulating the people, who is trying to lead people astray. And so he is so convinced in his own truth that he cannot see the truth that's in front of him. So this carries on, and I'm trying to skip as much as I can, and I apologize. So we've got this Jesus who has got a painful death coming, who knows it's coming, whose best friend has betrayed him, whose friends are at risk, whose own people have turned against him, whose high priests are actually misjudging him and conducting a sham trial, who has been abandoned by his friends and has been denied at least once now by a close friend. And he knows that there's two more coming. And as Peter starts to see that Jesus is losing the battle, the next time Peter is confronted, surely you're one of his disciples. Now, if Jesus had at some point said something, everybody had fallen down, the clouds had parted, the voice had come from heaven like we'd seen at the baptism, and that this, you know, and you have this moment, Peter was, I'm one of his disciples, I'm one of his followers, because it's really easy to follow God when he's winning. And Peter says, no. Why? Because Peter's trying to save his own neck. He's frightened. Who's afraid in this story? Judas is afraid that he's not going to get anything out of this, so he betrays him. The disciples are afraid that they're all going to get caught, so they run. Peter is afraid that he's going to get exposed, so he denies the truth. The high priest is afraid that he's going to lose control, and so he holds a sham trial. He goes to Pilate. Pilate's afraid that the people are going to rise up, but he's also afraid that he's going to condemn an innocent man, because here we have Jesus in the prime of his life, who has served people all his life, fed the poor, healed the broken, and now he is an innocent man in the prime of his life about to be condemned to the most excruciating death. This story is unbelievable. And Pilate's afraid. What is he afraid of? He's being afraid of misjudged by Caesar, of being removed from his position, of losing his position of influence and power, and maybe even being put to death by not obeying the law of Rome. And so he's also afraid of losing control of the Jewish people, of an uprising in his group. And so what happens as we begin to press this is we get to the point where Pilate is so afraid of the circumstances and so out of control over everything in the midst of power that when Jesus says to him, my kingdom is not of this world, those who are on the side of truth follow me, Pilate says, what is truth? Now Jesus is being tried by a leader that doesn't even believe in truth. And he is the head of the tyrants who are in power over the Jewish people.
I've got 3 minutes.
So he puts in front of the Jewish people a choice. You can either have Barabbas, who is, we read from the other Gospels, a murderer. John says is a robber. Because his focus right now is on the theft of what? Theft of justice, the theft of truth, the theft of innocence, the theft of power, the theft of... Puts in front of them Barabbas and says, do you want the king of the Jews? Notice he doesn't even call Jesus by his name. Because we don't even really care who he is anymore. Let's just make a mockery of the whole thing by calling him the king of the Jews. Not knowing that actually that's his name. Or do you want Barabbas? And of course they pick the criminal over the innocent man because that's justice. And the criminal goes free. And to top it all off, the criminal's name is the son of the father, Bar Abba. This whole thing is a tragedy.
There's no light anywhere in this. You read this whole chapter, there's no hope. The disciples didn't know where this was going. They're watching their entire world fall apart. And all they're doing is staring into the darkness.
Jesus in John 12 says at one point, he says, unless the Son of Man is lifted up, you won't be saved. And he's referring to Numbers 21, which is the story of Moses and the serpent made out of bronze that's held up so that people may be saved from the fiery serpents that are biting them. They've come out of oppression in Israel. They're in the wilderness. The serpents are biting them because they've been complaining that it would have been better if they were back under the tyrant. Here we have the Jewish people trying to use the tyrants to enact revenge on someone. They are putting confidence in the tyrant rather than God. Our laws don't allow us to put him to the death in the way we want him to die. You have to do that. Jesus' words in John 12, I've got to be held up like a snake so that they may be saved. How do you deal with fear? The best way to deal with fear is to intentionally expose yourself to that which is afraid rather than run from it, because you will always stay afraid. How do you deal with the fear of betrayal? How do you deal with the fear of death? How do you deal with the fear of your friends being at risk? How do you deal with the fear of your people turning against you? How do you deal with the fear of being abandoned? How do you deal with the fear of being denied multiple times by somebody who's just trying to save their own skin? How do you deal with the power of tyrannical leaders who don't even believe in truth anymore? How do you deal with unfair trials? How do you deal with the young in the prime of their life being taken and the mothers watching it happen? How do you deal with the killing of the innocent when everybody knows they're innocent and yet it's justified anyway? How do you deal with murderers being set free? How do you deal with being just a nameless victim? You gotta look at it. So I stared for a week into John 18. Through Putin. Through World War II. through the betrayal of friends in my own life, through my own injustices that I've done, through the misjudgment of others, through the abandonment, through the absence of those who should have loved us, through those that have denied truth, through those that would deny the circumstances we're in, through those that run just to save their own skin, through, and behind it all is Christ. Who knows how I feel? Who stands despite it all? You'll notice throughout this story, he's the only one that's not stressed. And he's the only one not answering in fear. And he's the only one that has a grand purpose despite it all. That despite the rule of tyrannical leaders, and despite the betrayal, and despite the denial, and despite the abandonment of friends, and all the things that we can relate to in our lives through our stories and everything else that we've been through, whether it be broken relationships, whether it be jobs, whether it be wars or famine, or whether it be tyrannical leaders and what they have said and the power they have risen up to, whatever it may be, behind it all is a truth. One truth. The truth, the only truth, the author of life. And despite it all, he is the one who will still stand. We will hear next week of the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. When you bottled everything you have been through down. The invitation from John 18, and I'll finish here. The invitation from John 18 is that in the midst of your pain, in the midst of your injustice, in the midst of the betrayal, in the midst of the tragedy, look through it all. Don't run from it. Don't hide from the snake in bronze that is held up. And the invitation to our culture, the invitation to you if you do not know God, is to stare through Christ. Because in him you will find a source of life that defeats the greatest evils that you have ever experienced, that will undo you and will recreate you, and will make you into something majestic and glorious and full of light. In him we live and move and have our being. The story does not end with John 18, but John 18 is this story that invites us to stare into and through the darkness. Because through that, and the only way you can do it is through it, through facing the fears, not running from them, you will find the light of Christ, and that will give you life for eternity, not just a short-term gain. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the time we've had together. I thank you, Lord, for precious hearts who are eagerly seeking you. And Lord, wherever people are at today, whatever person we connect to in this story, Lord, meet us. And help us to know you in that moment. Not know what we think of you, not know what we think about you, not know expectations, but know you. Because it's you we seek. Amen.